You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded May 27th, 2026. Well, a few weeks ago, HondurasGate.ch, an anonymous site in affiliation with media outlet Diario Red, released intercepted communications among the Honduran leadership elite, including former president and convicted drugs dealing kingpin Juan Orlando Hernandez. What those conversations reveal is a real-time conspiracy of assassination and dirty tricks to remove democratic opposition and return Honduras to the post-2009 coup period known as the narco-dictatorship. Karen Spring is coordinator for Honduras Solidarity Network, a decentralized network of approximately 30 organizations from across Canada and the United States committed to demonstrating and advocating for solidarity with the Honduran social movement. Karen is too co-author of the just-released report, The Dark Side of the Energy Transition, Green Colonialism in Southern Honduras, a chronicle of corporate profiteering and bullying under the guise of sustainable development. Karen Spring in the first half. And what's really, really old is newish again on the Third World War front, as my second guest observes. The best way of learning how the men inside the Kremlin think is in the history of the Byzantine Empire, which began in the 4th century AD, and whose last day, the anniversary of the empire's last day, we celebrate May 29th, 1453. John Helmers, a journalist and author who's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the web news site Dances with Bears, and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, too, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among his many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia and Long Live Novichok, The British Poison Which Fooled the World. His latest at Dances with Bears is The Kremlin Tries the Byzantine Emperor Strategy. Trump can be bribed to start wars, stop wars, retreat, attack, do nothing. John Helmer and Trump, Xi, and Putin picking up where the Byzantines left off in the second half. But first, Karen Spring and the making of a green-colored colonialism in Honduras. Well, welcome back to the program, Karen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, before we get to the Dark Side report, we previously, you and I, we talked about the 2024 murder of human rights defender Juan Antonio Lopez. Now, there's been arrests made since we last talked, the former mayor of Tocoa, Honduras, Adán Funes Martínez being among them. Can you remind us, Karen, who Juan was and what work he was doing when he was assassinated?
Sure. So Juan Lopez is a very loved individual in Honduras. He is a land and environmental defender. For a while, he was called a water defender, but in reality, he was a defender of public and common goods, particularly in relation to anything related to the environment in a specific region in northern Honduras called the Aguan Valley region. Juan Lopez was a spiritual leader. He was very connected into the spiritual community, the religious community, in many different small rural communities and in urban areas in the area of the Aguan Valley in Colón. And he was really focused. One of his main struggles was trying to defend the Carlos Escaleras National Park, which is this really beautiful mountainous region in the department of Colón that was threatened by interests of a foreign-supported, Honduran-owned mining company that was interested in basically mowing down the national reserve to extract iron ore for export, and had a business relationship with one of the largest steel companies in the United States called Nucor. So Juan Lopez, together with his community, and he leading a lot of the resistance through the Municipal Committee for Common and Public Goods of Tocoa, that was the name of the organization, he led years and years of resistance against the mining company, against extractive projects that threatened the existence and the environment within the national park. And because he was such a vocal opponent of both the mayor of Tocoa, the city where he was, or the town, I should say, where he was also an elected representative of the village council. He was very critical of his colleague, Adan Funes, who is the mayor of the municipality, because the mayor had been so involved in promoting mining interests and allowing the mining company to operate in the region. And the mayor also had a lot of connections to organized crime. And so Juan Lopez was one of Adan Funes's biggest critics. And unfortunately, in September, on September 14th of 2024, Juan Lopez was assassinated in his vehicle in front of his spouse and his daughter as they were leaving church one evening. The gunman basically opened fire from the window of his vehicle, killing him and basically leaving a huge and very upsetting mark on the social movement in Honduras, the communities that loved and worked alongside Juan Lopez in the region as well.
Well, and it's also a continuity. We talked when we mentioned Juan's killing, it was in the context of your being down in Honduras earlier this year for the Berta Carceres Memorial, the 10 years, marking 10 years since that human rights and environment defender was murdered in Honduras.
Exactly. And I think what is really important about Juan Lopez's assassination is that Berta Cáceres, who was another environmentalist and land defender, she was indigenous, she was a leader, she was murdered in March of 2016. And then Juan Lopez was murdered, you know, several years later, 10 years later after, or 8 years later after Berta. And so the pattern of the danger faced by environmental and land defenders in Honduras, but, you know, to broaden it beyond Honduras, because it really is a reality in most of Latin America, that when individuals like Juan Lopez, Berta Cáceres, and many others in Latin America confront and oppose the very damaging extractive industry, many of which are proposed, these projects are proposed by companies coming from the US and Canada and Europe, they are met with extreme amounts of violence, threats, criminalization, imprisonment, and in the case of Juan Lopez and Berta Cáceres, murder. So, it's a pattern, like you said.
Well, and it doesn't seem to matter who's in power. When Xiomara Castro was president, there was a lot of hope that things would change. And yet it didn't really seem to, at least in Juan's case, it didn't seem to matter. And the environment still seemed to be a low priority and the people that defend it targets.
Exactly. And I think, you know, it's important to state this, that just because you're in government in Honduras or even in any country, really, it doesn't mean you're always in power. And so in the situation in Honduras, Xiomara Castro, unfortunately, Juan Lopez's case is sort of unique in that sense, because Juan Lopez was, as I mentioned, an elected council member in the village of Tocoa. And the mayor was from his same political party, which was also the party of Xiomara Castro, the Libre Party. So like you said, political parties sometimes don't matter at all. Sometimes they matter a little. But in Juan Lopez's case, he was very much, threatened by someone from his own political party who had very different views about the extractive industry than he did.
Well, I guess it could be said, too, that not only are the people in government not necessarily in power, but the people in power aren't necessarily in government at all. And this leads to the former president. It was a big story, the Honduras Gate revelations. They're still not entirely authenticated, according to some. But I, from what I've seen, that the reports are looks favorable to me. And maybe I'm just bent towards believing it. Can you describe briefly what the HondurasGate.ch report is about?
Sure. And just before I get into that, I just wanted to close the loop on Juan Lopez's case. So we're really hoping to see some level of justice, although there are lots of demands still that there be further investigations into what they call in Spanish the intellectual authors or the masterminds of the murder, the people that paid or that economically benefited from his murder and were very likely involved in murdering him. Now, going to the Honduras Gate scandal, that has been a scandal that's been reported I mean, it's not a scandal, it's a story. And it's just to give some background on it. So about a month ago, I think it's been, or 3 weeks ago, there were a whole series of 37 audio files that were leaked to the press and that were reported by Honduras Gate together alongside a Spanish news outlet called Diario Red. And the 37 audio files outline a range of theories, and they're mostly conversations between politicians and very influential individuals in Honduras, discussing both plans to manipulate and go after the current government who was imposed by Donald Trump, basically, in the elections of last year, talking about how they were going to go after political opponents in Honduras, but more broadly. And one of the main people that were featured in the audios was, as you mentioned, Chris, the former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was pardoned by Trump in December of last year, and that was fulfilling a 45-year court sentence or legal sentence in U.S. prisons after he was convicted by a U.S. jury for large-scale narcotics, cocaine trafficking, and drug-related weapons charges. So he was pardoned, and then these audios were leaked of him having several conversations about working alongside some people close to the Trump administration to form this sort of center in Honduras and in other parts of Latin America to confront what they call, I believe is what they call, sort of the communist or progressive governments in the region. And so talking about working alongside Argentina and working against progressive governments in Mexico, in Colombia, Cuba, and to basically work towards basically, you know, going after those progressive governments. And so for that reason, I call it a scandal, because these audio files were leaked. They sort of reveal all of these plans, both within Honduras, but also regionally, that go back to the role of the U.S. in Latin America more broadly, at a time when Trump is carrying out these very aggressive campaigns against Venezuela with the bombings of the so-called drug boats off the coast of Venezuela and off the coast of Colombia, as there's a lot of discussions about the U.S. and the Trump administration invading Cuba and indicting the former president of Cuba, Raul Castro, and then also intervening in a series of elections in Argentina and then Honduras as well. So it is quite a scandal. And just to talk a little bit about the audio files too, in Honduras, there's been a lot of skepticism about whether the audio files are true or not. A lot of that skepticism has been led by the more conservative or right-wing forces, obviously, because they have a lot to lose if, you know, the audios are in fact real and verified and authentic. But also because there's been a bunch of scandals related to audio file leaks. And so I think people are just experiencing a little bit of fatigue on audio leaks. But there have been efforts by international press, including Diario Red, that originally put out the audio files, that suggest that they are authentic and that they are real files.
And it seems like everything you describe seems like old times. It seems like, and I had in another incarnation of the introduction to this discussion, talked about the Operation Condor and how Honduras back in the 1970s was the center of this plan to wipe out communists and anybody left wing-ish in Latin America, led by the John Negroponte, the Americans, John Negroponte and Elliot Abrams out of the American embassy, the U.S. embassy in Honduras. And it seems a little bit of deja vu all over again. And from what I read about this, and I'm struggling to find it, look at it right now, because the actual site, the HondurasGate.ch site, has been hacked and attacked with denial of service attacks. And so I can't even get it to open right now. I'm reading it through a third source. But there was some technical assaying of this, of the tapes and of authenticity, and it it was, in their words, it was more than 80% that it they were genuine, that the tapes weren't deep faked or manipulated in some other way. And I was surprised when I was watching last night your webinar, which I'd like to get to now, that when I asked the question about the reaction in Honduras to the revelations, that it got crickets. And this was, of course, the webinar, The Dark Side of the Energy Transition, Green Colonialism in Southern Honduras. Can we get to that then, Karen, and talk a little bit about your webinar? Because I know these things connect as well as the characters behind the scenes involved, that there is a great cross-pollination of interests and agents in this.
Yeah, and just to close again the conversation on the Honduras Gate scandal, I think regardless of whether the audio files are in fact authentic or not, what I think Hondurans that do, you know, to a certain degree believe in the audio files and their authenticity, and myself included, is that even though, you know, these are audio files that, you know, are being questioned, they do have the theories that are promoted in them and are being confirmed by a range of events that are occurring. And so, for example, there's a lot of discussion about Juan Orlando Hernandez receiving support from Israel for his pardon from Trump, and also the expansion of these libertarian private cities that Juan Orlando Hernandez started when he was president and that still exist in Honduras. And for example, the new president of Honduras has developed very strong relationships with Israel following him taking office earlier this year in January. He's had one of the first things he did was recognize the Israeli representatives in Honduras, something that the previous administration under Castro did not want to do. And then with the ZEDES, or the Zones of Economic Development and Employment, these libertarian free trade zones, on steroids, basically. They also are advancing, and there's been some recent news that they are being promoted, expanding and considering once again the expansion of those zones under this new government in Honduras. So again, there's a lot of ways that the audio files can be found to be definitely contributing to explaining some of the things that are going on in Honduras. Now, getting to the report that you mentioned, so we launched this report that we've been working on since basically last July, and the report is called, as you mentioned, The Dark Side of the Energy Transition, Green Colonialism in Southern Honduras. And what we did with the report is that we are working alongside communities in Southern Honduras, which is an extremely dry area, but it's an area that gets a lot of sun. It's sort of like the sunniest area, the hottest area of Honduras. And there's been a concentration of large scale, internationally owned solar energy projects. And these projects have had a really detrimental impact on the local communities that live around these large scale solar panels. I'm not talking about panels on the top of your roof, or panels that are just like freestanding, a couple of panels. I'm talking like large extensions, hundreds of hectares of land covered in solar energy projects. And so the report seeks to look at the impacts that those solar energy projects have had in Honduras that were installed under the justification of, you know, moving away from fossil fuels and promoting the so-called green transition. And the report is not against solar panels, it's not against renewable energies, but it certainly is trying to expose how these discourses of green transition are being taken advantage of by international development banks and international companies that have a lot to profit from installing these types of projects, and that are in fact repeating the same types of models, the same extractive models that Juan Lopez was fighting against, the same ones that Berta Cáceres was fighting against, and that several communities in the US, in Canada, and around the world fight against, where you have these large scale projects that are coming in, causing extremely a lot of damages to the local environment, and that are excluding the voices of the local communities and not benefiting the local communities at all. And so that was the focus of our report launch last night.
And let's talk about it. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Karen Spring. Karen is coordinator for Honduras Solidarity Network, a decentralized network of approximately 30 organizations from across Canada and the U.S. committed to demonstrating and advocating for solidarity with the Honduran social movement. Karen is, too, a co-author of this report. We're talking in and around the dark side of the energy transition, green colonialism in southern Honduras. Let's talk about Los Prados. Who is behind this project?
Sure. So Los Prados is the large-scale solar energy company that we focus a lot on in this report. And Los Prados is, when it was originally approved by the Congress, that was then led by the president of Congress was Juan Orlando Hernandez, in an early morning session that was completely illegal and it was outside the scheduling of the Congress. The National Congress of Honduras approved a whole series of renewable energy projects, and within those that series of contracts was these 9 projects that were all supposed to be really small projects, but later were purchased by 3 Norwegian companies, including a development bank. Norfund is a development bank. It's public. It's owned by the Norwegian state primarily. Skatec and an investment firm called KLP Norfund Investments, also from Norway. And so these 3 companies funded or purchased these 9 contracts that were originally obtained by drug associates of Juan Orlando Hernandez. When, as he was president of Congress, he was sort of granting his drug associates these solar energy contracts. So these drug associates sold these 9 small projects to these 3 Norwegian companies. And the 3 Norwegian companies amalgamated them all into one large mega project. And so the communities in southern Honduras started seeing how the companies, all of a sudden, these big tractors would show up to their communities and start clearing land and cutting down large trees that had been around for like hundreds of years, according to the local communities, and then also burying water sources, because southern Honduras is very close to the Pacific. And so there's a lot of different like little pools of water or lakes and streams in that region. And so they started clear cutting these large scales or large sectors of land, they also were burying water sources where local people would go to fish to get, you know, shrimp or to, you know, find fish for their own local consumption. And so the local communities started resisting and started trying to stop the construction of these nine solar projects that form part of this Los Prados mega project. And they were able to stop 6 of the 9, but they have faced criminalization as a result. So trumped up charges against several leaders that were opposing the installation of these solar energy, this specific solar energy project. And it's been 8 years since they have faced these charges. And the company, the Norwegian companies and the Honduran government have refused to like move and progress and sort of push forward the legal case so that they can demonstrate their innocence in a trial. And again, this goes back to sort of some of the topics we already spoke about, Chris, about Juan Lopez, about Berta Cáceres, and what environmentalist land defenders and local community members that oppose these large-scale projects face. And so that's exactly what we were trying to expose in our report launch. And I mean, we've just focused on Los Prados project because of the damages of that it's done to these people's lives, because they have to go and sign into a court to meet the conditions of their bail. But there's also a whole series. There's like 30-something solar energy projects proposed in that area, the small area, the dry corridor is what it's called because of the lack of water in that region and how hot it is. They're proposed for that region, and a lot of them are owned by U.S., Canadian, and also companies that are tied to the Central American elite or the wealthy families that have long dominated Honduras and other countries in Guatemala. And so that was the focus of our launch. And we were really trying to build support for the communities. And we did a launch this morning that was directed towards an audience in Europe and Norway.
The meadowlands is what Los Prados, the meadows is what it translates in English. And the mead, this is where the Vikings went to get their mead, presumably, their source of mead. And it's this bucolic name that they put on what is basically the destruction of nature on a massive scale. In your key findings on this, on the dark side of the energy transition, you talk about this, the green energy being used as a stalking horse or a lever to, quote, dismantle the public state electricity company. So there's a lot more at play here than just the money being made by corrupt officials and their drug gang associates.
Yeah, I think so. What's happening is that there's been a really extensive effort, particularly in the name of the green transition or the so-called green transition, you know, the movement away from fossil fuels, to increase the investments and the involvement of the private sector. So transnational companies in constructing energy generation projects, whether that's hydroelectric dams, whether that's wind, biomass, solar energy, etc. And so in Honduras, what that's meant is that in order to have private companies generate electricity, you have to privatize energy generation. You have to privatize the public electrical energy company, which is called the ENE in Honduras, but is called, you know, it exists in many other Latin American countries, these public institutions. And so it's actually better for the public institution or the public energy company to obtain, it's cheaper for the public to obtain and build, obtain funding to build their own energy generation projects. But because of this green transition, because of this big interest, this economic interest in getting in on the profits that the green transition can mean for many private companies, there's been this whole effort to dismantle and to privatize the public energy company. And so what happened under the previous administration, the progressive government of Xiomara Castro, is they decided that they were going to start building projects that were publicly owned. So they built solar projects that were publicly owned. They didn't want to give any more private companies contracts to generate electricity because it's more expensive for them to do that. And they started to revert and roll back privatization efforts of that public energy company. And so what happened is, in response, these private generation companies, because the government also said, listen, we can't pay these electrical costs, these generation costs that are required to pay you to generate this electricity. It's too expensive for us. So we want to renegotiate your contract with the public energy company that is in a financial crisis. And the company said, no, 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 we are not allowing that. We are going to file an international arbitration suit against you. And so in the case of Los Prados project, the three Norwegian companies filed two ISDS, is what it's called, investor state dispute claims, in a international arbitration tribunal housed in the World Bank. Mm. And they filed a two suits of $200 million each against the state of Honduras, to say, no, 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 you cannot, you're rolling back our contract, even though it's in the interests of the Honduran people and the interests of recovering the public electrical energy company and the interest of lowering energy costs for Hondurans. We're going to file these really extensive and expensive suits against you because of your attempt to basically affect our profits. And so that's something else that really ties into what we were talking about with the dark side of the energy transition, these efforts to privatize, to generate more profits for the private industry that are actually not good for the environment, that are actually cause significant damages to local communities, and that ultimately undermine the ability of governments in Honduras, but also Canadian, US, like all across the world, this ability for private companies to go and file arbitration lawsuits against states that are trying to protect the environment and protect their populations. And so that's what we really wanted to emphasize in that report too.
Thanks a lot for coming on again, Karen, and especially for the super important work you guys are doing. It's posted, again, the report is The Dark Side of the Energy Transition, Green Colonialism in Southern Honduras. And I've got it up at the IPS-DC.org site. Is that the best place for people to go to read it?
Yes. So the Institute for Policy Studies is based in D.C., so that's the best place for people to find it. We launched it in English, and then we're going to launch it in Spanish in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, in July.
ips-dc.org. Go there and read The Dark Side of the Energy Transition, Green Colonialism in Southern Honduras. Thanks a lot, Karen, for coming on and telling us a little bit about it today, eh?
Thank you so much, Chris. It's such an honor to talk to you again.
Oh, get out of here. I'm going to take a break and I'll be joined by John Helmer. And we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on the other side of the world between the contretemps of the giants, the titans. Thanks again, Karen.
Great. Thanks so much.
When nothing is as it's presented.
It's a bit like discovering that your favorite uncle has taken you for walks in the park, whether that he's a